Thank you. My name is Jimmy Dean. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a nervous alcoholic. I never get used to doing this, especially in the beginning. I'm from Dallas, Texas. We're famous for the Dallas Cowboys and Johnny A. I would like to thank Al King. I would like to thank you. You know, we had a good time in our room this morning. I was thinking, I said, this guy looks sober. And I kind of wanted to find out who he was. So I grilled him. I'd like to thank Tim and Kim for picking me up at the airport and so graciously feeding me. Plus they paid. You know, we always like that one, you know. I've been kept clean and sober since June the 10th, 1982, because Alcoholics Anonymous works. And because along the way I found that God loved me, and I never had that information before. I'd like to start this talk off with a line, the first words I ever heard come out of the mouth of our founder, Bill Wilson. And I was headed out to West Texas to give a talk in a prison a few years ago. A lot of years ago, 7, 8, 9 years ago. And someone gave me a tape, and it was a man named Bill W., and it was from 1956 in Fort Worth, Texas. And I did not know who he really was. I thought, damn, Bill W. was over a long time. I stuck that tape in my tape player, and the first words I ever heard our founder say were these words. He said, there's a new hope and a new light that shines on the loneliness and the darkness and the brokenness of an alcoholic, and it's the 12 steps pioneered by Alcoholics Anonymous in 1939. And I got cold chills and I got tears in my eyes, because before I found Alcoholics Anonymous, I had no hope. I put the L in lonely. I was afraid of the dark, and my life was broken. I lived a basically broken life until I found you. And that little line has always had a lot of meaning to me. So without further ado, let's ask God in this meeting, and I'll tell you my story. Thank you. I want to split this up, half and half. They say you got to get to AA by 8:30, man, or you're not doing good. They don't let us tell one-hour drunkologues in Dallas, Texas. Good or done. You know, I'm always amazed at what gets out of my mouth first. There's so much going on up here. But let me say this. I like to go and start at the beginning and try to end up at the end. That's kind of simple. This is a very simple program. And I came from what they're calling out there a really basic dysfunctional family. But I don't use that word dysfunctional too much because it don't get there enough. Bizarre would be another good word, but it don't reach for me, so I don't really basically use it. So let me tell you about a little bit about where I came from. I'm the second of 10 kids. I was raised in the state of Kentucky. I was raised by a woman that left home when she was 15 years old. She started having children when she was 16 years old. She had me when she was 17. I'm the second child. And she went on to have 10 children. She had a basic flaw in her personality. And that was, no guys ever hang around. I'm trying to be nice. And so I never knew who my father was. And I grew up in a little place called Clarksdale Housing Projects. And I kind of just grew up. Let me tell you a little bit about what that was like. As a little bitty boy, I never knew what I was supposed to do around people. And I came from an environment that was kind of tough, and I found out that there are environmental aspects of alcoholism. And so, if you were a nice little old lady, I'd be the sweetest little kid you'd seen that week. You know, if you were a real gorgeous little girl, I'd be hip-slicking cool. And if you were one of the tough guys, I'd swell up and talk about, I've been kicking ass all week this week. Because I didn't know whether I'd come out the door, if you were a tough guy, if you were going to knock me down or put your arm around me. And then every now and then I'd get around four or five of y'all at the same time. I'd damn near have a nervous breakdown. You know, and another thing about my life is I never could tell the truth when I was a kid. That's such a ugly, crazy kind of... the truth was I always lied and made it look a little better. You know, in fact, I'd go tell people my father was a baseball player if they don't know who I was, you know, things like that. The next thing I remember that's real basic was that I was real poor. And it affected me in a kind of strange kind of way. The thing I remember about my childhood was looking at pretty girls and thinking they could see all the way down through my soul, and they could see that I stuck cardboard in my shoes because I had holes in my shoes. I remember carrying a peanut butter sandwich to school because I didn't want to take those damn lunch tickets that they gave me. I would walk through the line and they would hand me and I'd have a lunch ticket, and everybody would be giving money and stuff in front of me, and I'd give them this pink lunch ticket. I think one year it was blue. And it made me different. I don't remember a whole lot about my childhood. I remember that I was basically lonely. I didn't get along with my brothers and sisters. I always wanted your mother, your dad, your brother, your sister, you know. And so I got to be about... You know, you and I do that. We look up one day, we're 15 years old, we're 14 years old. I got to be about 13 years old. And this is going to be an awesome part of my history. I looked across the room, and there she was. And I said to myself, what do I do now? The rockets are going off, the light bulbs are flashing in my head, you know, what do I do now? And so I went home and tattooed her name on my leg. Her name was Georgetta. I tattooed her right down here. I had Born to Lose tattooed over here. It's the truth. And so that's how I met my girlfriend Georgetta. And Georgetta and I got between these two houses, and her father was kind of crazy. Her father worked night work. And when it got dark, we started kissing. And we just kissed for about 3 years. That's all I remember about Georgetta, is we kissed for a long, long time. But what I would do is I would go and break up with Georgetta about every 3 or 4 weeks, because that's what you did where I came from. You let those girls know who's running the show. One day I went back. And I carried the thing that was significant in this relationship was this old junk ring. And when I had it, it was cool. When she had it, it had about a pound of tape underneath it. You know, I'd tear that tape off. And one day I took the ring back and I said, here's the ring, baby. And she said these words, it's over. I went, my God, what do I do now? And one of my buddies told me, she said, man, you better go get Georgetta. So-and-so's making a run on her. Now, so-and-so had a 49 Ford, and I had a 58 Schwinn. So you and I know who won that deal. No, I couldn't make an attempt. Because, you see, I'm one of those people that's always comparing, and I'm usually down here. And I'm not going to be able to make that happen. That's not going to be good. And so the thing that I can report to you is the first significant relationship that I was ever in that had any matter, and you know, hell, this ain't the Lions Club. You know, that's the only thing that matters to us is that boy-girl stuff in the beginning. And I wish one day I thought, my God, why didn't I say, hey, baby, don't go? You know, but I grew out of an environment where I was going to be a real man, and you never, real men do not ask for help. Real men do not do things like that. And I walked away from that relationship. The thing that was going to happen in my life because of that, and because of the pain and the agony and the abandonment, if that's the right word, I've really felt abandoned, was that I was always going to have a backup in all my relationships until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous 27 years later. I always had somebody waiting in the wings in case this didn't work out, because I could never, ever, ever go through that pain again. In the beginning of the book, Silkworth says, "You and I drink for the effect of it." I love the doctor's opinion. You see, when I found Alcoholics Anonymous, I always thought I was a bad person. I've always been taught that I was different. I'll tell you what, after you hear my story, you see where I lived that out. If I'm bad, okay, I'll show you what bad really is. And so I started drinking as a 12 or 13-year-old kid to take away the pain. And the reason that I knew that I drank to take away the pain was because in the beginning, I'd hold my nose and drink that crap, because I damn sure didn't like the way it tasted, especially Thunderbird wine. Not a good choice of drinks. I quit school when I was 15 years old. I got a job as an errand boy in the dental laboratory. I started delivering false teeth. Put me together with a rock and roll band when I was 16. I sang in a band for about 5 years. And I met her again when I was about 17. And her name was Ethel. And I was singing in a band, so I don't got to go tattoo her name on me now, you know? I mean, she kind of liked me, and I kind of liked her, so we got married. And we got married basically to get out of these housing projects, because I had moved from housing project to housing project, and now in my third set, man, I want to get out of these damn places. And we started having children right away. I remember in the beginning, we were going to have 3 kids, we were going to get that little house with the picket fence, and I was going to do what I saw all these other people doing. You know, I was going to be a real man, I'm going to get me a job and be a husband, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and I'm going to do this right. And lo and behold, by the time I was 18, 19, 20 years old, I was a full-blown alcoholic doing major amounts of drugs, because I came out of an environment where we started sticking needles in us when we were teenagers. And my relationship with my wife was going downhill, and I ended up having 3 children. Their names are Dory, Petey, and Melissa. And I remember that my life was a mess. I could not understand why I couldn't do what other people did. Make a long story short, I started going to prison in the late 60s and early 70s. I went to prison the first time for... what did I go to prison the first time for? Writing those hot checks, government checks. You know, you get them out of the mailboxes. And so I got a 3-year sentence, and I went to prison. And I didn't like jail, so I escaped from jail. You and I do things like that. You know, we don't ever think about what's going to happen. If I could undo anything in my life, one of those things would be that. I got to prison, and now I want to be a good husband. Now I want to be a good father. Now I really miss my kids, you know. I really miss my wife. And so I want to be this thing that I've never been. So I'm writing these letters and talking about how this is how I'm going to do it. Get your house with a picket fence. Make sure all the kids go to college. And when I get out, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do this. She must not have went for it, because I didn't get any letters back. I'd been in prison for about 17 months. And I had one of those things that happens to you and I that changes our lives forever and ever. They called me to the chaplain's office, and the chaplain said, "Mr. Daniels, has been a terrible tragedy in Louisville, Kentucky. They found your wife, and she's been murdered. It's an unsolved murder. You have this escape on your jacket. We're not going to let you go to the funeral." I can report to you in my 14th year of sobriety that that's probably one of the greatest things that ever happened to me, that they didn't let me go to that funeral. I started having letter writing deals going on with these 3 little children that no longer had a mother, that were talking to psychiatrists and writing these children letters about how I'm going to be a good father. I'm going to make sure you go to college. I'm going to make sure I keep all of us together when I get out of this mess. And on and on and on and on. And I meant every word of it. I'm sober 2 days, and Tom and I were discussing this. You know, when you really, really, really bottom out, And our founder talks about it on the life page of the 12 and 12. Says, when you're really bottom out, and you have to bottom out for this deal to happen, there's something major that happens to you. And that is, you begin to hear with dying ears. And I'm 2 days sober, and there's a man taps me on this shoulder. I call him Angels. And he said, hey, man. He said, you know that everything you did before you got here was the best you could do? And if you could have done it any different, you would have? And I started crying. Because I knew this man told me one of the most awesome truths about my life, about you and I, and that is that everything we've done before we get here is the best we can do. I got out of prison in 1972, and I went to see my little children. But my little children were raised by my in-laws. And I got these, you and I are also the only people that can look at somebody and tell what they're thinking. And I'm looking at these in-laws, and these in-laws are saying back to me, had you been a real man, our sister would still be alive today. And the only thing that would take that ugly hole out of my gut was massive amounts of alcohol and drugs. I went back to prison again for burglary. Got a 2-year sentence for burglary. I got out of prison after doing that stint, and I went to prison the third time. And I'd get out of prison, and I'd go to my wife's grave, and I'd bawl, and I'd cry, and I'd talk about how I'd like to trade places with you. And so I got out of prison the second time, and I went to prison the third time for armed robbery on a bunch of drugstores. I got out of prison in 1979 after doing 5 years in prison. Now I got a major thing going on inside of me. I have this awesome dilemma. I keep ending up in the penitentiary and don't know how I get there. it's kind of funny after the fact, you know. And so this is what, you know, it says in the book that self-knowledge avails us nothing. I always thought that I'd get something in my head that'd make things different. So this is what I decided to do. Somebody said to me one time, you need to be a real man. Quit shooting that stuff, man. And just smoke it and drink it and snort it. And I thought, hell, sounds like a hell of a deal to me, man. This is what a real man ought to do, I guess. So that's what I did. Now, one of the things in my life is I used to go and tell people that I was a dental technician. And by the time they found out I wasn't, I learned a little bit more. And one time I got a job when I was on escape from jail. And I went and told this guy in Columbus, Ohio. I said, I'm a dental technician. You know how we say it. Tuck her little chins down, telling lies. He said, well, come on, work for me for a couple of weeks. I went to work for him. He said, look, man, I don't care what you tell people you are, but we're going to pay you minimum wage. So they knew what I was. I was a phony. I got out of prison, and I went and found a job in a dental laboratory. And I told this guy I was a dental technician. He said, work for me a couple of days. Well, I worked for him for a couple of days, and he gave me a job making $5 an hour in 1979. He said, sorry, but you know what he said? I never will forget this. He said, you know what? You got potential. He said, you know what potential means? That means you ain't done it yet. So this is what I did. You and I go on these missions. I quit shooting drugs. Started drinking vodka, because this old man that I work with, and I never had a father, so I take these older people on kind of like for father stuff. And I just love this guy. So he drank vodka, so I drank vodka. What do you drink? Whatever you're drinking. And I started drinking this vodka. At the end of a period of 17 months, I was drinking 2 quarts of vodka a day. I got 4 DWIs in 22 days, and I went to the penitentiary the fourth time for being a drunk. Now, I was just a stick-up man. Now I'm a drunk, you know. But you know what? I was not an alcoholic. My luck was just a little bad. 2 quarts of vodka a day, not an alcoholic. Major symptom besides the alcohol is denial. Got out of prison March the 16th, 1981. Got a younger brother in Dallas, Texas, and the thing I know is I got to get out of Dodge. I got to get out of Louisville. I keep going to prison there. You know, one of the first things I heard also, too, is you and I take these geographics. I went, oh, my God. So I got a younger brother in Dallas, Texas. Now, I've been locked up 4 times, about 12 years, just about 12 years of my life, and I'm thinking, I'm going to spend the rest of my life in here. Because my dilemma was that I did not know what was putting me in prison. So this is what I did. I got a younger brother in Dallas, Texas. I'm going to go down there. And, you know, I think the problem is the felonies. If I quit doing the felonies, I quit going to prison. Okay? So I'm going to go to Dallas, Texas, and just do misdemeanors. Got to Dallas, Texas, met a girl. She took me to a concert, so we moved in together. My kind of girl. I had $1,000, so you know what I did? I bought me a leather jacket and some alligator shoes. You know, clean this outside up, buddy. That's all that matters. And when I wasn't looking good, I wasn't feeling good. Went and told a guy I was a dental technician. He hired me. You know why he hired me? He had a little lab he was putting together. He said, I'm starting a new lab. And I had this yellow pad. I was taking notes. You and I do that. I was taking these notes. He said, can you set up teeth? You bet. Well, go in there and make me a full upper denture. Well, what he didn't know, I put him together a full upper denture in about 20 minutes. Because I was loaded with that Texas crank. Man, I was flying. And all this guy could see was these dollar signs. You know? Well, to make a long story short, within a very short period of time, I couldn't tell you the difference between a felony and a misdemeanor. And I got worse, and I got worse, and I got worse, and I got worse. Early May 1982, I lost my job. I lost my girlfriend. I wrecked a car. My brother gave me this old 71 Maverick. And my dilemma, my gauntlet, my cross was that I knew I was going to prison for the rest of my life, and I did not know how to stop it. That was what was in my heart. This is kind of a bizarre story, but it's the truth, so you know we have to tell this stuff. Little voices inside said, don't give up. Don't give up, man. Don't give up. She's out there. She'll save you. You see, I always thought that you women had the power to save me, could fix me. You know, and a little voice inside said, yeah, man, your knightess and shining armor still out there. So this is what I decided to do. I decided to go run, get my body back together like it was when I got out of prison, when I lift weights and the girls were waiting on me, you know. And what I didn't realize is that I was a 40-year-old man, and it looked like I was about a 60-year-old man. But see, you and I have this thing in us called we're survivors. And this is the last mission I was going to go on before I found you. And I found this field on Greenville Avenue in Dallas, Texas. I still go by there. There's a shopping center there and there's stuff. But I can go by there and picture what it was like the day I was there. With the sun shining down into the meadow behind it with the trees around it. I had about 6 beers. It was really important that I got a headband, running shorts, and some tennis shoes. I ended up with a pair of tennis shoes ragged as a can of kraut. I don't know where I got them. But see, I was going to run. I'm on a mission. I'm going to find her and she's going to save my life. I started running around this field and I broke down on the ground and I started bawling and I started crying and I started cussing God. I said, God, of all the people to do this to, why have you chose me to do what you've done to me? And I started naming them off. I said, you never gave me a father. You made me poor. You killed my wife. You kept me locked up all my life. What do you want from me? One of my favorite lines in our literature is this. It says, the great fact for us is we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences that have changed our whole outlook. And I just had my first one. I crawled up off that ground and something was different. You know, there was just something different. 2 days later, I'm knocking on the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous at the Alpha Group, Webb's Chapel and Northwest Highway. I remember they had a piece of glass in the door and they had a piece of paper stuck up in there and they said, only 12 steps to go. You know what I said? I said, God damn, they must be holding on a roof. And I walked up those steps and my life has not been the same since. The great miracle happened for me because I had reached that place where I was able to listen and the miracle came alive for me right away. Two things I'll share with you. That thing that Bill Wilson talked about, that if you bottom out, you get to hear with dying ears. Well, years later, I'm going to discover a monk named Thomas Merton when I was about 3 years sober. And one of the things I do today is I go back east and hang out in monasteries for relaxation. I just love to be around those guys. Thomas Merton says, the word is called fire not only because it gives light, but especially because it ignites. And I would hear those miracles come out of your mouth, like we're all God's kids. If one of us ain't, none of us are. And I'd say, man, I'm in on that one. Because I always felt like I was a stepkid. You don't got to live like that anymore. Fake it till you make it. Hell, I've been doing that all my life. I know that works. You and I know fake it till you make it works. I had a guy said one day, he said, you know what, we can get a list of 10 things about the answer to our problem, we'll guess it, which one it is. I got a sponsor. Somebody said, hey man, your best thinking got you here. I realized that my best thinking had me sleeping in a 71 Maverick. I had three miracles happen to me when I first drove up. I'll tell you about the one I think was the first one, because it mattered so much. You see, Alcoholics Anonymous turned me from a tramp into a businessman in 2 days. Now that's kind of heavy, you know? And it did it on three little principles that I learned in the program. The first line I heard in here was somebody said, you know, the only thing you need to do to be a businessman is to have a customer. I said, I'll be damned. They just put me in business. Because there was a young dentist that saw how fast I made these dentures, and he was a rookie, and he said, if you ever want me to do my work, come get it. So I showed up and I got his work. And I went from making $10 a denture to about $100 a denture. I thought, man, Jesse James used a gun. And I built my little dental laboratory on three principles that I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. Fake it till you make it. Repetition strengthens and confirms. And I think the big daddy of all the principles here, and that is to be willing to go to any lengths to make it work. And day by day by day by day, I built that. I can remember John. This just comes to mind. My first year of business, I made about $1,400. And I don't know about you, but if you live the life I've lived, see, I have got in touch with the fact that I have always suffered from a welfare mentality. I think one of the greatest things you ever taught me was to be self-supporting through my own contribution. It was the beginning of self-esteem for me. And from June until December, I went up and I found these people. And she was an accountant. And I had my little stuff in a little brown bag, my receipts. And I'm telling her, she said, well, you know, you're in trouble, son. She said, you know, you don't owe any taxes. I said, well, do I get anything back? And John said, man, that's welfare. Hell, you don't get nothing back. The government ain't supposed to take care of you. You see, I always thought somebody's supposed to take care of me. You know? I still got brothers and sisters that think that. So I'm a businessman. Can you imagine what it's like to be in Alcoholics Anonymous and have lived the life I've lived, and now, in 2 or 3 days, I'm a businessman? You know why? Because I got a customer. God said it, you know, I'm a businessman. The next thing that happened to me was that I got this awesome struggle going inside of me, you know? Usually when I go do this around younger people, I tell them how long I've been sober, and I say, and that's the truth. Because, you see, I didn't believe you were sober as long as you said you were when I got here. I thought you was lying about it. Because I'm comparing what's going on inside of me with you, and there's no way possible you can live for 10 years with this animal inside of you. But I hear God say, hey, man, I got 8 days. I say, my God, now how'd you do that? That's the guys I hang around with in the beginning. The guys that had 4 days and 7 days. And then I'm sitting in a meeting one day, and one of the great miracles happened for me, and it is one of the greatest miracles of my life. Heard a guy say, if you're struggling with the phenomenon of craving, I thought, my God, man. He said, here's what we do. So we get on our knees and ask God to keep us sober. And we get on our knees at night and thank Him. This is the exact scenario in the same words. I got to use them. Little voice over here, I'm saying, little voice said, man, you're going to go for some weak shit like that. That fast, another little voice said, man, you've gone for weaker shit than that. You better try that one. 2 or 3 days sober, 4 or 5 days sober. These drunks, they got me hiding in mop closets, locking myself in filling station bathrooms, and getting on my knees and asking a God I didn't even believe in to keep me sober, and then find a place at night to thank Him. A week or 10 days later, I'm standing around. All of a sudden, I got that glow. I said, something's different. There's something different. And I realized that thing they call the phenomenon of craving had been snatched all the way out of me, and I didn't even know it was gone. And when you got miracles like that going on in your life, you know the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, I wasn't an alcoholic when I got here. I was a hip, slick, cool drug addict. And I shot that stuff too, man. I robbed drugstores. I was a tough guy. And they started saying things like I heard my friend Tom say. They said, hey, man, won't you look for the similarities? And I can remember the day the great miracle happened for me, and that's when I sat in a chair and uttered these words. My name's Jimmy Daniels, and I'm an alcoholic. And when I quit drinking alcohol, all the other stuff stopped. You see, I had a problem with it. I couldn't go. I said one time, I said, you mean I can't have one beer? Everybody said, no, that's right. And I had a problem with that. I'm sober 3 or 4 days, and I called my sponsor. I said, I'm out of here. I said, another one of those miracles that happened. I said, I'm out of here. This program, I can't do it. I said, you know, y'all are too sweet and nice and honest. And I said, plus I can't go the rest of my life without drinking and drugging and the girls and all that. You know, I can't do it. He said those words that changes our lives, that has changed mine since the day he said them. He says, you know, you don't have to go the rest of your life. He said, we just do this deal one day at a time. And went, bing, bing. And I've never been the same. You know? It's like somebody stuck a rocket up my butt. I'm like, no. Now here is one of the miracles. This is such a bizarre story, but usually I hear people going like back here going like this. You see, I never had to worry about a higher power because I always had one, and it wore a dress. It wore a dress. I got two nods back here. Thank you. And when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the things I learned also was it's hard to find God when you're sleeping with Him. And I went, my God. And you know, when I come to Dallas, I met this actor. I used to call people and I say, hey, man, I got an actress. They say, oh, really? Is she in any movies? No, man, she's an unemployed actress, you know. But I couldn't get over the fact that I had an actress. Me. You know, nobody. This girl went to college. She likes me. You know. And she left me. So there's a hell of a difference between being the lefty and the left door. You know, I've left a lot of women, but, you know, and that hole in my gut, you know. And I would have done anything to get her back. One of the reasons I got here, wanted her back. But I ended up staying for the big reason, and that is for myself. My sponsor one day said, thank God for these sponsors. My sponsor said, what's going on with you? I said, oh, man. Nothing, man. I'm a real man. And I was going nuts. About the third day, I called him. He said, hey, man, he said, you may want to start sponsoring me because I ain't doing so good. And I thought, man, this conversation ain't supposed to be going this way. He said, what's going on with you? I said, and the voices. Y'all know the voices? Don't you tell that grown, real man you love that girl. You see, another of the great miracles of Alcoholics Anonymous was that I never was able to tell anybody the truth before I got here about what was really going on, especially the girls. I remember I got married just because I was going to prison the third time, and I knew the woman would take care of me. Hell of a good reason to get married. I think I fell in love to the best of my ability. I fell in love with the visits, the cigarettes, the money, the clothes, you know. And then I got a serve out, you know, and this woman had said, hey, I love you forever. Well, love forever turned out to be 11 months. And she left and I thought I was going to die. And my butt, I walked around for 3 years with a walking nervous breakdown. Anybody ever had one? She's had one, yeah. And that is one of those things where you know if you snap, you'll never get back. I was dying. And my sponsor said, what's going on with you? And the voice said, tell him. And I went, I love this girl, man. She's got a boyfriend or doing it, and I'm dying. I know that's killing me, man. I think I want it. And it's the first time I've ever told the truth to another guy about women. You know what he said? That's great, man. That's wonderful. Everybody gets here like that. They either want to get rid of somebody or get somebody back. Now, here's what you do. He said, here's what you do, man. Pray for her. And boy, that was my eye. Pray for her. I'm dying. I'm literally dying. Y'all know what she's doing. And I'm going to pray for her. I need the prayers. They need to be praying for me. Couldn't do it. Couldn't do it. I was sinking fast. Either or. I'm going to do something. You know, I had prayed to have the craving snatched out of me, and the only thing I know is that that had worked. And then one day it got so bad. The other prayer that Alcoholics Anonymous taught me was somebody said, if you got something going on in your head and you want to get rid of it, ask God to take it. This woman loved Kenny Loggins. I hated him. She made me hate him. I didn't even know him, and I hated him. One day I fell on my knees and I said, God, give her Kenny Loggins. And I got better. And I got better. And I got better. And all day long in my early sobriety, my prayers were very simple. God, take it, 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 God, take it. Because everything going on in my head was not nice. God, give her Kenny Loggins. God, give her Kenny Loggins. God, give her Kenny Loggins. God, take it, God, take it, God, take it, God, take it, God, take it. 2 weeks later, I looked up. And it was almost gone. That thing, that ugly thing that happens between people that's not healthy, had been erased from me to where I could work, I could live out here. You know, this is the only way I know to share it with you, is that I went to prison 4 times with those crazy kind of relationships. 3 of the women I never got to see again. Well, it's major loneliness. And I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, in a week's time, I'm starting to heal to where I'm going to be able to live amongst you. They told me in prison I was incorrigible, that I couldn't live out here. Whew. Thank God we don't buy that, huh? And so because those things happen, you see, I've not even started doing these steps yet. Not even started doing these steps yet. Because those things happened, I started with my sponsor, working through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got stuck in the second step. They want me to tell them I was crazy. That's what they want. They want me to tell them I'm nuts. And then I got the definition for insanity. It's doing the same thing over and over and over and expecting different results. I applied it to going to prison over and over and over and expecting different results. Took me about a year to walk through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous the first time. Got stuck on step 4. Third column. And y'all know the columns. the column. It affects our self-esteem. 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 I'm saying, what the hell is self-esteem, you know? You never had any self-esteem. How the hell do you know what it is? I think we build self-esteem. I think, you know, I said earlier, you know the great miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous is we found out God loves us, and you started loving me. I started getting my worth from you telling me. You see, I still didn't believe it. And then I would look back and see where I had gotten better, and I'd gotten better, and I'd gotten better, and I'd gotten better. And in a year sober, I'm one of those people that stayed out of relationships for a year. You know why? Because the thing going on with me is, if this program don't work for me, I'm going to prison for the rest of my life, and I'd rather be dead. And so I bought that stuff about not having sex and stuff, you know. I got to think, hell, I never did it unless I was drinking or drugging anyway. Hell, it might not work. So, you know, I'd rather not do it than go through one of those deals, you know. And at a year sober, I looked across the room one day, and there she was. It was a God deal. Beware of those God deals. Because it turned out to be an un-God deal. And for 5 years, I got to know how to get along with you women, you know. And the way you do it is you get in there and you have one of those relationships. You know, I had some things happen to me. This is what I want to share with you about how you get better along the way. A couple of little things. When I was 6 months sober, I could get away with 2 towels and Worcester egg and everything out of a motel. When I was sober a year, I could only get away with a hand towel. I went on a trip when I was about 3 or 4 years sober, and a little voice inside, I stuck a wash rag in my luggage. And a little voice said, "Don't even think about it. Put it back." And I was telling my buddy, "You know, I never had any luggage before I found you people." True story. A lot of us don't have. We know, hell, I didn't need no luggage. What the hell do I have luggage for? You get out of prison, it's cardboard boxes, you know. You go from girl to girl house, and it's paper bags, double big brown grocery bags. I looked up one day, and the guy had my shirt on. I said, "Where'd you get that shirt, man?" "Judy's house." "Oh, man, she's giving away my clothes." The other thing was this. When I found, you know, the people that have affected me in legitimate, bona fide ways. They've changed my life. I've heard them say things. The words they've said have changed my life. I found a monk 3 years sober named Thomas Merton. Fell in love with him. And I found him because of this line. He said, "How do you expect to reach your destination if you take the road to another man's city?" And I'd taken the road to every man's city but my own all my life. 3 years sober, I broke up with my higher power. She broke up with me. Let me get that right. And at 3 years sober, I went out on my own for the first time. My first apartment, my first telephone. Can you imagine that? Yeah, you can. And I was lonely. And my mother always, she said, "I hate cats. God, I hate cats." And I had this buddy named Ronnie McAllister. Big old boy. And I was always a skinny, frail little guy. And I hung around Ronnie McAllister because he took up for me. Except then one day he popped me in the mouth. They usually turn on you, you know. And he used to say, "Let's go kill some cats." And I used to say, "You know, I hate them cats, but I don't believe I want to kill any today." And I'd find a way not to get off into that. And 3 years sober, I got me a little black cat. And his name's Perry. And he's been my little buddy for 10 years. And I got to go make a call and check on him here in a few minutes, you know? Somebody told me the people that have pets do better. You know? And I got a black cat and a white cat. The white cat is a tramp. He won't eat. The only thing I can do is feed him. He bites me and he bit me one time. And I got Perry. And in 5 years sober, I got another awesome lesson in Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to hear these guys say, this baffled me. I used to hear them say, "If you put anything between you and God, you'll lose it or you'll lose your sobriety." And I thought, man, they ain't talking about me. I got Miss America on my arm. I got 12 doctors, you know, I got money in my pocket, I'm traveling, I got an apartment in North Dallas, and in the beginning it was always about stuff for me. I remember that line in the book. It said, material progress always follows spiritual progress. Never does it precede it. That'll make you want to know who God is, won't it? That'll make you pray. You want some of that stuff. And me and my girlfriend had been... David A., I heard him say this one time. He said, you and I are the only people in the world that handcuff ourselves to each other and lose the keys. And Leslie and I have been handcuffed together for about 2 years. Neither one of us had the courage to say, see you later. I was getting ready to do this for the first time. I called her and I said, you want to go hang out and do this? She said, Jimmy, it's over. And my life ended as I knew it that day. And 5 years sober, I had to reach a new level of surrender and sobriety. Because once again, my higher power had booked on me. And lo and behold, I got to really find out what Alcoholics Anonymous was about starting at 5 years sober. Because I got two major lessons 5 years sober, and that is, number one, money can't fix you, and the women and relationships will not fix you. They will not make you okay. I thought they would. I thought money would. The way you find out money don't fix you is you get a big pocketful. And I had got to be a legitimate businessman 5 years sober. I had about 25 doctors and was doing... And I saved up this enormous amount of money. And at 5 years sober, I needed to do something with drunks. And I am a very fortunate drunk in this respect. I got to start my own treatment center and my own foundation 5 years sober. It's called the Ethel Daniels Foundation. It's in Dallas, Texas. And for 8 years, we had a 22-bed halfway house. We lost the funding on that. But today, we're an outpatient program and an AIDS program. I don't have the words to tell you what it's like to have lived the life I've lived, to have been a terrible, terrible husband, and to have a foundation named in my little wife's name. The biggest miracle of my life, and I don't know why I've named these things as miracles tonight. I think that's valid. Happens to be my relationship with my three children. My three children. 4 years sober, the book did it to me again. Book's heavy. The book will nail you every time, right? I got these three kids, and we're arguing, fighting. They want money. I thought, God, they're going to take all my money. All they want is money. One Father's Day, I heard from one of them. I said, man, I ain't giving none of them nothing anymore. But they know who I am. Man, I've been sober, and I've been trying to do this. And I read, and it's at the top of page 18 in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and describes what you and I have left in our paths out there. And this is what it says. This is my marching orders with my three children 9 years ago. And it said, this is what we left in our paths. Work lives of blameless children. And I realized at that time that it was going to be my job to help mend the lives of these three broken children. Twelve years sober, I was riding along the street one day. It's like God moved into my car. And he said these words, hey boy, your kids are now treating you like you've treated them for the past 12 years. I have a really nice relationship with my three children. We went on a vacation a few months ago in Florida, and I go home every Christmas, and they come down here, and my boy's a really awesome golfer. We're going to meet in Florida next weekend, Thursday night through Sunday, and I'm so excited about that. And you taught me how to be a father. I remember when I made amends to my children. I told my sponsor, I said, hell, I ain't never had no father. How in the hell do I know? I know how to make amends to them. He said, tell them you were wrong. So I told all my children I was wrong. I always like to get current, too, in this deal. So I want to share with you probably one of the two or three major amends that have happened in my life. It's kind of a long little story, but I want to end with it. My children were raised by my in-laws. I hated them and they hated me. Hell of a deal. I have no problem with that. We kind of shove it back and forth. I tell my kids stuff and they tell them. My kids say stuff and they tell me. My in-laws told my children on a daily basis or a weekly basis or whatever who I was, where I was, and what I was. He ain't no good. They got him in the penitentiary, and evidently they got the right guy. They keep taking him back. I told my mother one time, I said, "Mom, I ain't never going back to that penitentiary." You know what she said? She said, "You must like it. You keep going back." And we didn't like each other. Last year, a friend of mine came up to me and said these words. Said, "Hey, did you ever make amends to your in-laws?" And I went ballistic. I said, "Let me tell you something, man. You might not, I mean, it was a girl. Lady, you don't know this, but I don't like them, and they don't like me, and that's kind of how it is, okay?" Now, John and I have got a real close friend in Fort Worth called Jim W. And he's sober 30 years, and he has this wisdom, and you know how we like to do that. You know, the thing I can report to a newcomer is that it keeps getting better. If it didn't keep getting better, I wouldn't be your speaker tonight. It keeps getting better. And I like to talk to these older guys that let me know that it keeps getting better. I went to Fort Worth, and I said, "Man, do I owe these people amends?" You know what he said? "Hell, I don't know." I don't know. Hey, that's how they talk to you. That's how the real ones talk to you. So I'm in a dilemma. You know, I'm squirming. Okay? Last June, Melissa, my youngest daughter Melissa, called me. She said, "Hey, Pop, I'm going to get married." I went, "Oh, my God, there is a God. Melissa's getting married, you know." And she said, "Will you walk me down the aisle?" And oh my God. And I ended up marrying my daughter, and I ended up paying for it too. And I'm still paying for it. Big old wedding. My friend said, "Hey, you're going to go back and be around those people. When are you going to thank those people for taking care of your children?" And the walls came tumbling down. I said, "My God, I haven't thanked those people for taking care of my kids. They raised my children." One of my sister-in-laws, the one that hated me the most, no wonder, gave up her whole life and raised my children. Let me share with you the reasons that I know this prayer works and this program works. About a year and a half ago, I went all over the world chasing meditation, chasing our spiritual program, to monasteries, to different deals, trying these things called Zen. And a friend of mine said, "Why don't you try what's in the book?" And 12 years sober, I'm going to repeat it, 12 years sober, a little voice said, "Why don't you try what's in the book, man, like you said?" And I told my monk friend, Brother Luke, and Abbey of Gethsemane, I said, "Hey, man, I'm going to start working on the meditation prayer. I'm going to start working on the St. Francis prayer." You know what he said? "Jimmy, do it till you own it." And I started meditating on the St. Francis prayer 20 minutes a day, 5, 4, 5, 6 days a week. And I believe that prayer is the reason that this stuff happened. I'm not going to quote the whole prayer, but the prayer says this: "Lord, make me a channel of thy peace. Where there's hatred, I may bring love." And I hated my in-laws. "That where there's discord, I may bring harmony." And you're talking about discord. "And where there's error, I may bring truth." And there was a major error in that, and it was my part. I had never thanked those. I had never gave those people the recognition of taking care of my children and of doing that stuff for me. Last year, I wrote 3 letters to those in-laws. And I said these words: I want to thank you for taking care of my children when their mother died. Your kindness and your compassion has made it possible for me to attend my daughter's wedding, something I never dreamed possible. And so I thank you much more than you'll ever know. Sincerely, Jimmy. And I mailed it. All three of them. Same letter. 3 days later, my oldest daughter, Doris, said, Dad, Donna called and said, what are you doing putting him up to writing those damn letters? She said, I didn't put him up to it. He did it himself. I said, all right, Doris. So then I went back to the scene of the crime. I went back to my hometown to marry my daughter. First one I ran into in front of the church is Donna, you know, the one. She looked away and stuck about this much of her hand out, and I went, oh, my God. My God, 23 years, and she's going. The next one I seen is my mother-in-law, and she came up and hugged me and kissed me and licked on me and loved on me. And then I seen my sister-in-law, and we wrote hate mail to each other, and it's in their eyes. It's in their eyes. She loved me, and she came up, and she said, we're glad you came, Jimmy. I went, oh, man. But you know what I did at the whole wedding? I'm always trying to figure out where Donna is. You know? And I'm on the way home, and I'm kind of sad about this trip with Donna. I wrote this letter. I did, you know? All of a sudden, there's an empty seat in my plane. It was like God started sitting in that plane. He looked over me and he said, hey, son, he said, you need to know that 2 out of 3 ain't bad. And I got okay with it. And today, my relationship with my children is something that I never dreamed that was going to happen because of this. And so I will close with these words. There's a new hope and a new light. It shines on the loneliness and the darkness and the brokenness of an alcoholic. And it's the 12 steps pioneered by Alcoholics Anonymous and the people and the literature. Thank you for having me as your speaker. Thank you, man.